Hello and welcome to yet another off-season edition of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by Matt. And today we will also be joined by Petey Buckets from By George and the Hey 10 podcast. We're going to go over a little bit of a season recap, kind of looking back to the funnest parts of the 2019-2020 season. So we go team by team and talk about what memory should most live on for each of the 14 A-10 teams. So, Pete, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. Behind enemy lines tonight. Feels weird.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. Just another great podcaster in the A-10. I really think we've had a good run of them coming on this offseason. Pete, we'll start with you. Which team memory you want to talk about first?
Sure. Just kidding about enemy lines, by the way. We think you guys are great.
Oh, of course.
I guess we'll start with my George Mason Patriots. You let me pick first, so I don't know where else we would start.
Yep.
I think are we just talking about what's like the big fun thing that happened this season? Because I think from a Mason perspective, it's definitely the AJ Wilson breakout season. He was a junior last year, but totally came on, not just in terms of his defensive game, finally put it all together, but also saw some really nice stuff at the end of the season, like started stepping out and hitting threes. I think he started the season one for 10 through like the first 15 games, and then hit a couple of game coming down the home stretch. So really, really excited about his breakout, excited to see what he can do again next year.
Yeah, so for me, I chose a game that may have been AJ Wilson's best performance. Although not necessarily on the stat sheet, 14 points, 11 rebounds, 5 blocks, but fantastic defensive game and really a great beyond the box score game for him. And that, of course, is February 12th when they went on the road and beat VCU 72-67. Now, maybe doesn't feel like that impressive of a win as we saw how VCU ended the season, but this is when the Rams still had some life to them. George Mason was struggling, just kind of stuck in the bottom of the conference for the whole first month of the year. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they walk into the Siegel Center and basically rip VCU's heart out like the crazy priest guy in Temple of Doom. And that was it. VCU never recovered from that game. So Mason fans probably enjoyed the fact that they got to ruin one of their longtime rivals' seasons.
Yeah, that's talked about a lot on the Mason boards, is that sort of like we ended VCU season, because if you look at their game log after that, it was just, that was the, we like to think we got the boulder started rolling down the hill there.
Yeah, so that game was actually my moment too that I picked for George Mason. And before I talk a little more about that, Petey, I'm just curious, what was your reaction to that game? Because that was a huge upset for George Mason.
It was. And I think, Matt just made the point that in hindsight, it doesn't, maybe it wasn't as great a win as it felt like. But coming into that game, nobody was giving Mason a chance. I think Mason is like 14 point underdogs or something. Like, VCU had problems that we found out about later. But in the moment, that game was incredible, because I think Mason played a good first half, but, VCU took the lead into halftime, if I recall. Mason came out strong in the second half, but then VCU took the lead again with like 14 minutes left about. And then Mason went on this crazy, like 17-0 run or something, to put the game, and VCU kind of made it a game at the end. But, this was, Mason had lost 4 in a row coming in there, and nobody, like, no Mason fan thought that we were going to go in there and win that game. We were expecting our routine ass whooping at VCU. So you're absolutely right. It was a long, hard season for Mason. That was absolutely the bright spot. It's a rivalry win on the road. Felt great. Maybe wasn't as good as we wanted it to be, looking back in hindsight. But if you're looking for moments from this Mason season, it's slim pickings.
Yeah, I think you guys can definitely take credit for ruining VCU's season. And we actually, I keep a spreadsheet of all the A-10 scores and point spreads throughout the season. And I believe Mason's upset that night, they were 14-point underdogs. I think that was the biggest upset against the spread of the season. So that was pretty exciting. And
that's a fun fact, yeah.
Yeah, and at the time, VCU, I want to say they were like 8-3 or 9-3. They were coming off a big win against Davidson, and after that, they only won one more game the rest of the way. So pretty, I guess it makes sense in hindsight, but at the time that was pretty wild. So that was a fun game.
Yeah, and I know we got to move on from Mason, but I also got to mention Mason won the Cayman Islands Classic, which was pretty cool. You know, not a tremendous field, but, you know, beat Old Dominion, Nebraska, and then New Mexico State in the championship game, staged a pretty cool second half comeback there. So I would say those are the two moments. Me personally, I will always take the win over VCU.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that's a good time for me to mention. Honorable mentions are okay if you can't narrow it down to one, because I couldn't pick just one Dayton thing. That was kind of impossible. So if you have anything else you want to add on to any of these teams, that is totally fine. And I guess, Tyler, with that, we can move on to you for your first pick of a team.
So I just want to get this one out of the way. And Petey mentioned the Cayman Islands Classic, so I'll go to LaSalle. And this was a team that just kind of had a nondescript season, just never felt like they had a great moment, but not exactly that many games that were embarrassing losses. But they did have a really nice end of November, winning the Gulf Coast Showcase, which is pretty not known tournament, but when you look at it, they beat a pretty good field to take it. Murray State in the first round, Wright State, who won the Horizon League regular season running away in the semifinals, and then a pretty decent South Alabama team in overtime the night before Thanksgiving to lift the trophy. And, you know, that's a pretty big who's who of low major powerhouses. And LaSalle looked great that whole week.
Yeah, I think for LaSalle, that, like, I'm looking through LaSalle's KenPom right now, and the similarities between LaSalle and Mason are startling, because LaSalle was like, what, 9-3 out of conference? And
I
then
think
just
so.
6-12 in conference. Mason was like 11-2 out of conference and 5-13 in conference. So some similarities there. For LaSalle's moment for me, I would say the Bonaventure win. Because that was it was late in the season. They'd been dealing with some turmoil because I think Ed Croswell had left the team before then. That was another one. Curious to see what your spreadsheet says in terms of total upset there. I know they were at home, so it might have been not quite as big of an upset, but that was another one where I think everybody was just like, everybody's penciling in a win for St. Bonaventure. But no, LaSalle, they came out. I think they shot really well from three that game. I think that was a big in-conference win for them.
That was a big win at the end of the year, and I think it was after Croswell left, so that was nice. I'm just going to say this, LaSalle was by far the hardest time I had coming up with a good moment, but I think I got a good one. So Scott Spencer played his first year with LaSalle. I want to say he transferred from Clemson, and he led the A-10 in three-point percentage by 0.2 over Nick Sherrod from Richmond and Bones Highland from VCU. But the story behind this is pretty interesting. So Spencer sat out two of the last three games, I believe including that St. Bonaventure game, then came back for the Big Five rivalry against St. Joe's to go 2-for-2 to secure the crown. That's a pretty heroic effort in my eyes. I don't think that got talked about probably at all in the A-10 community, but good for Scott Spencer. He set a record for LaSalle this year, or he at least led the league in something. It was kind of hard outside of the December tournament that the Explorers won. Not too many other good things happened, but I thought that was interesting that he was able to come back on that last day of the season to go 2-for-2. So good for Scott Spencer. Don't have too much else to say about LaSalle, although they have managed to avoid the pillow fight 2 years in a row now, getting the 10 seed both years. So that's also kind of interesting.
Yeah, Scott Spencer. So his 2-for-2 performance actually kept LaSalle out of the pillow fight.
Really? They won by 1 point.
They won by 78-77 over St. Joe's, and if they lose that game, they're in the pillow fight, I believe.
It's crazy.
Yeah, because they jumped GW, then GW had to go beat Dayton on the road to stay out of it.
Yeah, that's like Ted Williams getting like five hits in the last day of the season in a doubleheader to bat 400. He needed to set that mark for the conference, so good for him. All right, that's enough for LaSalle. I guess I'll make the next pick. Let's go over to UMass, because my moment I thought was pretty exciting this season, even though I wouldn't call it the high point for the Minutemen, but the post-game altercation between UMass assistant Tony Bergeron and Rhode Island freshman Jacob Toppin was really the closest thing we had to a fight in the conference this year. And I guess you could apply this to Rhode Island season, but since it had a UMass coach involved, I gave it to them. I just feel like that was interesting because Bergeron has kind of become a polarizing figure in the A-10 with his shiny suits and his just ability and his connections to Woodstock Academy. So I thought that was kind of fun. Got a decent amount of buzz around the conference. So that's my moment for the Minutemen.
Yeah, that was awesome, by the way. That whole altercation scrum there. That was like it was probably one of the biggest like hold me back events I've ever seen. It's like all these guys like posturing like they want to fight, but nobody's actually gonna fight.
No.
Not in today's college basketball age. Yeah, I think that's good. I think I want to take a little shot at our friends from UMass, but I think UMass playing their asses off against Rhode Island in the last game of the season and then still losing on what everybody agrees was a bogus call.
Yeah.
That's a very like definitionally UMass moment from the last like 5 or 7 years of UMass basketball.
Yeah, totally
so
agree.
Through 19 minutes and 57 seconds, that was the easy pick. The final 3 seconds are so controversial that ESPN left them out of the game play-by-play on the app. But Trey Mitchell had 34 and 12 in that game, and it still probably makes it – it would have made it an easy high point if there wasn't so much controversy. Outside of that, I mean, their two best wins, they pounded Duquesne and St. Louis at home. But for me, just given that it was such a topsy-turvy season, I actually picked a loss for them. And that's the February game to Dayton. And this was really the true coming out party for Trey Mitchell. 26 points on 11 of 12 shooting, 10 rebounds. And even though they lost to the Flyers, everybody did this year. And that was a game where they really held tough after getting blown out in UD Arena a month earlier. And like I said, that was the Trey Mitchell might be a coming superstar party. And if UMass is going to be a top 4 team this year, it's going to be because Trey Mitchell becomes a superstar. And we might look back on that being the game where he really started to come alive.
Yeah, I was scared that game. UMass cut it to like 3 in the final minute. And they really started turning it on at the end of the season. So I think you're right about that. Trey Mitchell's he's due for a big year, that's for sure. All right, Petey, we'll go back to you for your next pick.
Oh, crap. I don't have a team ready. Let's do GW because they're the first one I looked at.
Mayhem.
So, our buddies from Mayhem.
Yep.
All right. So it's tough to pick which Fordham loss is the best moment of GW season. No, I'm kidding. Let me pull them up here. So GW. The Davidson win in 4 overtimes. That's got to be it, right? There's no like. Is there even another contender at this point?
Yeah, that was big for sure.
Four overtimes, and the game only ends 107 to 104.
By far the easiest pick of any team for me. That was the most mayhemic game of the entire A-10 season. And to have GW be the team that won the King of Mayhem games, it has to be mentioned. And Davidson should have won that game like 3 different times and just kept throwing away final possessions, but GW hung in there. Maceo Jack played 57 minutes and scored 35 points. It was probably the funnest game of the A-10 season, just from a pure what the hell is going on standpoint.
Yeah, I agree. That was a super fun game to watch. I actually didn't pick it, though, just because to me, what I'm going to take away from this GW season is that they lost to Fordham 3 times. And you could say, I mean, GW wasn't expected to do anything this year, and maybe going 6-12 in the A-10 is a little bit better than some people thought they would do under a new coach, but I don't know. To me, losing to Fordham 3 times is just ridiculous. That erases any of the strides they made. And I don't know, maybe Mayhem is just a bad scheme against whatever you want to call Fordham's system, but it worked, and that's how Fordham got all of their conference wins. So for some reason, maybe Fordham's just extreme slow tempo and bad offense kind of silenced the mayhem from GW. It's hard to explain that.
I'm still stuck on the I'm still stuck on the four overtime game because the box score is so incredible.
Oh, it is.
Amir Harris was 0 for 10.
Wow.
In that game. Yeah, and then on the other
and
side,
played 41 minutes anyway.
Played 41 minutes. It's incredible. And then John Axel on the other side went off, 31 points, 10 rebounds, 6 assists. And he still, like, that's how bad the rest of that Davidson team was. They still lose on the road to GW.
Yeah.
I think that's GW.
Yeah. All right, Tyler, what's
the one
pick?
Other thing I'll remember from the GW season is just the fact that Arnell Potter came absolutely out of nowhere.
He did.
He was basically a benchwarming scrub before Jamie and Christian showed up. And then turned into a borderline all conference guy and a pretty good point guard.
Yeah, he was good. He's a senior. Yeah, they're not going to have him back, right? He's a senior. But yeah, like in all seriousness, I like GW coming up this year. They had a lot of good freshmen last year, Jamison Battle in particular. Mm-hmm. So I know we've joked on him a lot, but I think they're like, you know, I'll be very interested to see what they do.
Yeah, I like Christian as a coach too. I think he's bringing in a lot of good talent. So I wouldn't be surprised sometime in the next couple years if he gets them back to being where they were under Mike Lonergan as one of the better programs in the A-10. That would be good for the conference, so I'm hoping they start to build some momentum. And yeah, I joke about the Fordham games, but seriously, I think most people would have had them winning fewer than 6 conference games, so their season wasn't a total waste by any means.
Yeah, and just to wrap up GW, fun fact, after playing 41 minutes in that game, Amir Harris played 44 the rest of the season, although I think he got hurt.
Oh, yeah, I think he did.
So I'll move on to my next pick. We need to get out of the bottom here. And so I'll slide up to Olean, the St. Bonaventure Bonnies. And for me, I got to go with 80s weekend. This was a thing that was incredibly hyped up by SBU Unfurled and Bonna commenter, to the point that they got Adrian Wojnarowski to give 15 minutes about his favorite Olean drinking spots and how much he likes watching AJ Vasquez off the bench over on their pod. And this whole crazy hype weekend that came after Nelson Bocciodum completely destroyed them the weekend before, it all leads to a pretty sizable win over Richmond at home. A Spiders team that was absolutely rolling at that point. A Spiders team that then picked up the pieces of the loss and just kept on rolling again. Really the only bad game Richmond played after Blake Francis came back. And it was only a 4-point margin, but this game was basically never in doubt in the second half. St. Bonaventure just kind of bullied them from the start.
Yeah, for Bonaventure, I thought you were going to say Gannon Fest.
I was thinking about that too.
80s weekend, I was like, was that Gannon Fest? Because, yeah, the our friends at Bonna get a little bit silly with that stuff. But, yeah, I would say, so, yeah, it was close for me. I would say the Duquesne game because they went on the road to wherever it is that Duquesne plays their home games. And that, I think, was it wasn't just, I think, a good point in Bonnie's season, but I think it was on the short list of probably the best played games in the A-10 this year. And I think that's like, it's a little bit of a commentary of like there were not a lot of like great games in the A-10 this year. But I think just start to finish, the Bonaventure Duquesne game was really high level basketball. And it was a big win for the Bonnies because it was later in the season. And in terms of, it was in early February, but I think that was what set them up to ultimately get into that fifth place finish that they got there, and they were competing for a top four all the way through to the final weekend, and that was a big reason why.
They had two great games. I'm actually going to pick a moment from the other game that was at the Riley Center, and this is just because St. Bonaventure fans have an unfortunate tendency to interfere with the game on the court when things get close, and probably everyone didn't see this, but that night, Sincere Carey at the line with the chance to send the game to overtime, a St. Bonaventure fan threw a balloon on the court, and it just brought immediate memories back to when the Bonnies stormed the court against VCU, incurred a technical foul, and then ended up losing in overtime. So, but yeah, the first game too at Duquesne, I mean, both those games, and really it seems like most years, St. Bonaventure and Duquesne have been pretty evenly matched, and I think they usually play home and homes against each other, which is a lot of fun. But yeah, I just had to go back to when a student almost, they didn't get called for a technical foul this time, but that brought back immediate memories to the VCU game from about 3 or 4 years ago.
So for me, the beating Duquesne was the other choice for St. Bonaventure. It really was, as Petey said, just one of the best games in the conference this year from a back and forth standpoint. But there were also other moments. This was the ultimate crunch time Kyle Lofton game. This was Amadi Peasy completely saving the Bonnies in the first half when basically all of their good players were in foul trouble. And to me, just looking forward, most importantly, this was the Jaron English breakout game. And he was just absolutely incredible in that one. And I know he was playing well for a few weeks before that, but he really kept it going after that. And that's the kind of game that I look back on when, as I will talk about as we get closer to the season, when I say that Jaron English is a potential sleeper superstar in this conference.
All right, well, I'll go next. Let's go back to the preseason favorites that did not quite live up to that billing, the VCU Rams. And really, if you want to look at good moments from VCU season, I only see one great option, and that's the early season win over LSU. And that game lived up to all the hype. I was super excited for Will Wade's return to the Siegel Center. And with the FBI agents in the crowd, the close game, that was just one of the best moments of the non-conference season for the entire A-10. And as many VCU fans will remind you, that was a win over a top 25 team at the time. I don't know if LSU stayed there for long, but that was pretty exciting for VCU. Really, that was the high point. I think everything kind of slowly came down back to earth after that, but I was happy for VCU, even though I don't like them very much. They deserved a win over Will Wade, so I'm happy they got that.
Yeah, I think so. LSU is the obvious choice. I think if you're looking for another moment from VCU for this year, I think it was the other Richmond game, the first one, where they beat them at home. So it was a big rivalry game. It was in late January. VCU won that game to go to 6-2. But I think they were, I think, tied with Richmond in the standings coming into that game, or they were very close to each other. We knew these were going to be two A-10 contenders. And then VCU absolutely waxed them. So 87-68 final score. I think they were up 15 or 20 at halftime. Richmond was never in the game. When you're in a rivalry game like that, that's just a, you know, it's a great way to win a rivalry game like that between two teams that are supposed to be fairly even. So I think it's obviously LSU with the FBI guys pointing at Will Wade. Those guys were hilarious. But the Richmond win, I think, is a strong contender.
The LSU win was probably the high point of the season, but it was such a weird game, and it really got forgotten as the Rams started to fall apart. So I actually picked a game back in January, coming off of back-to-back losses to Dayton and Rhode Island. The Rams were starting to look a little shaky, and then they welcomed the Bonnies into their house. And this is the Welcome to the World Bones Highland game, where he gets his first career start and immediately scores 17 points in the first half. VCU was up 52-24 at the half over what we later realized was a very good St. Bonaventure team. But it was kind of the last great glimmer of hope for VCU in conference play. And, you know, Bones was really the story for them down the stretch as all the seniors got hurt, as Marcus Santos Silva started to really kind of dip in offensive production as other teams focused a lot more on him. And Bones was the last great light for that team as the season flickered away.
All right, so we have six teams down, I believe. Petey, I think it is your pick if you're ready.
All right, let's go ahead and let's pick on our friends at Davidson. yeah. I think Davidson really just an odd, bizarre year that they had. I would say the Rhode Island overtime win, I think, was their high point of the season because first of all, it was a really well-played game. if I'm recollecting correctly. Fats Russell hit a huge three to actually tie it and send it into overtime. I think that it was supposed to be a close game. I forget who was favored, but it absolutely lived up to the hype. I think probably the second best game in the A-10 this year. And ultimately, Davidson was able to pull it out down the stretch, even though they did give up a lead in the second half. But I think that if you're looking through the box score, John Axel, 23 points, Kellen Grady, 21 points, 12 total rebounds for John Axel, which makes no sense. The dude's like 6'4".
Yeah.
That would be my moment from a thin season for Davidson.
Yeah, for me, it's the Pac Line game where they beat St. Louis 71-59. And not a great played game. It was actually pretty tough to watch. But this is a Davidson team whose biggest weakness the past 2 years has been interior defense. And, of course, St. Louis just eats up weak teams like that for breakfast. But Bob McKillop in this one reminded us that he's still got it, that he is still one of the legends of college basketball. And just says, screw it, I'm putting everybody in the paint. Coach Ford, just figure out what you can to try to break us out of it. And, I mean, it kind of worked for SLU. Javonte Perkins goes 5 for 9 from three. Tay Weaver goes 5 for 10 from three. But other than that, they got absolutely nothing from anyone else. And Davidson just amazingly holds St. Louis to 11 made twos in that game. That's the biggest part. The other one, John Axel drops 20 with 8 rebounds. And this was at a point in the year where we had just really seen nothing from him. And it leads directly into his big breakout game, which comes a few days later when he puts up 27 on George Mason.
Okay, so for Davidson, this is kind of a cop-out because I didn't really pick one game, but it's more just a theory that I've had about them for a couple years, and maybe I'm one of the only people thinking this. I'm not sure. But anyway, to get back to the start of the season, Davidson was picked second. Unfortunately, they had some early injuries, and their season never really got off the ground, so they only ended up at 16-14 overall. But I thought it was really interesting that their KenPom rating went up 15 spots. They went from 85 to 70. Compared to 2019, they went 14-4 and finished second place in the A-10. So I think this says two things. One, the A-10 was way better last year. Anyone can tell you that. And two, this just, I think, supports my theory that Bob McKillop instructs his teams to run up the score against bad competition. And just looking through their schedule, in the non-con, they beat UNC Wilmington and Coppin State, both by 35+. They beat UMass by 35, Fordham by 30, the Bonnies by 29 on ESPN. They just embarrassed them on the road. And then LaSalle by 25 at the end of the season. I feel like if you ask the average A-10 fan, is Davidson the 70th best team in the country? I think you would probably get a resounding no. And a lot of that has to do with their perception as a preseason favorite that disappointed. But I just thought that was really interesting how, even though everyone sees Davidson as a huge disappointment, and a lot of that has to do with the injuries they had early in the year, and Keyshawn Pritchett never even got to play a game, I think. But still, I just thought it was interesting how they actually managed to improve in a lot of the analytical areas. So, didn't really pick one game for them, but I just thought that was kind of an interesting trend. And I still do believe that McKillop runs up the score, but that might be a discussion for another day.
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting punked right now. I think I've said the same thing. They light bad teams on fire.
That's what I know. I've been saying that for a couple of years, and it seems like it always happens. Like,
yeah, sorry, we agree. They love beating crappy teams by like 35 points, and then they have a lot of trouble against good teams, like in years like this one. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Nobody who watched them play this year thinks that they're actually number 70 in the country.
Yeah, we'll see. And the same thing happened if you go back. I don't think 2019, but in 2018 when they won the A-10 tournament, they were third or fourth in the regular season, and they ended up with the highest KenPom rating in the conference. Kind of the same thing. I don't think people would have had them as the best team that year, but I went through and again, they just consistently blew out bad teams. And I don't know. Maybe McKillop's aware that can help him in the selection process for the tournament. I have no idea, but maybe he's just a bad sport. I don't know at this point. But anyway, that's what I had to say for Davidson. We'll see what happens next year. All right, Tyler, I think it's your turn.
Yeah, so I'll keep it at the top and go with the Rhode Island Rams here. And for me, it's the win over VCU, that huge Friday night ESPN2 game to end the month of January. A game that I think people forget was looked at as possibly being the game of the year in the A-10 going into it. These were the two teams that were fighting for second place behind Dayton. Rhodey ends up getting a resounding blowout win to move to 8-1. They were breathing right down the Flyers' neck as the calendar turned. And the things I'll remember for this game most notably is just how the two guards took over. This was the Jeff Doughton game for the first 15 minutes. As VCU tried to take Fats out of it, Doughton just found his way into a nice mid-range jumper, followed up by a layup, then a corner three. And he was the guy for the first 15 minutes of this game, something that we just really haven't seen from Jeff Doughton in the last 2 years of his career. And then after that, VCU's defense started to break down. The Red Seas parted, and this became the ultimate chapter of the Fats Russell domination story of this year. He ends up with 30 points on 6 of 15 shooting, but most impressively, 18 foul shots attempted. He goes 16 for 18 from the line. VCU just had no answer for his speed the moment that he broke free from them trying to corral him up top.
Yeah, that's interesting that you choose that one, because I actually chose the first VCU game. If I'm remembering this one correctly, people were like I think the valuation of the two teams was just way out of whack at that point in the season. I believe Rhode Island was like an 8-point dog or something on the road at VCU.
So. Yeah.
And again, this was when VCU was still full strength, so it's not the same VCU team that ended the season. It was like a very good team that VCU put on the floor. But Fats Russell, 7 steals. The game was an absolute rock fight, 65-56. Neither team shot well at all. But Rhode Island held VCU to 15 of 39 from 2, so under 40% from 2, and only 6 of 28 from distance. I think that was sort of the moment when people realized, like, Rhode Island is absolutely a contender in the A-10. It sort of solidified that their personnel is just a bad matchup for what VCU rolls out there, because I think they're were they like 8-1 or something, like Jeff Doughton,
yeah,
and
Fats
Russell
so.
Against VCU, yeah. So I think that was the point it started to click, because Rhode Island had not they didn't end the out of conference particularly well or like really on a high note, and I think this is when it started to click for not only for Rhode Island, but when people started to realize like that we might be working with something with this Rhode Island team here, because they went down to VCU and made quick work of them.
Yeah, it has been interesting how those guys, Doughton and Langevine, really dominated VCU over their careers. And I would definitely say those were the high points, those two wins. I looked at an interesting trend for this one. So after Rhode Island dropped their season or their A-10 season opener at home against Richmond, which was kind of a questionable game for them, they went on a 10-game winning streak before losing to Dayton. And I thought this was pretty interesting. You don't see 10-game winning streaks that often in conference play. So I just quickly went through, I guess, what I would call the KenPom era, just back to 2002, since it was easy enough to pull up schedules from all those years. There has only been a 10-game winning streak 12 other times in the A-10, just in conference games only. Except for each of those other 12 teams, except for, I guess, technically not Dayton this year, but all of them were headed to the NCAA tournament, and Rhode Island was not going to the tournament. So I thought it was kind of interesting how they put together this huge, impressive winning streak right in the beginning of conference play, but they really didn't make the most of it, and I guess maybe they lucked out by having the tournament getting canceled, because unless they won in the A-10 tournament, they weren't making it. And I really just think inconsistency was a big theme throughout their season. They lost a terrible game to Brown right at the end of the non-conference. They just about lost to Fordham. And then overall, they dropped 4 out of their last 7 games. So just didn't finish strong. Although at their peak this season, in January and the beginning of February, they were easily the second most dangerous team in the conference behind Dayton. And that was just a really impressive stretch of games.
Yeah, I really talked myself into Rhode Island beating Dayton at one point. I did not think Dayton was going to go undefeated in conference. I thought Rhode Island was going to be, you know, the team to knock them off. And, you know, Dayton told me where to shove that opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the two of us were both worried about each of those Rhode Island games. That's a team that's historically had a lot of success against Dayton. And the first game at UD Arena, the Flyers open up, I want to say, with a 17-0 lead. And then the second game, Rhode Island Senior Night at the Ryan Center, Dayton wins by 27. So kind of surprisingly, Rhode Island didn't really stand a chance against Dayton, which going into the season, I thought those were going to be much tougher games, but just didn't work out that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that got glossed over at the end of the year, just given the timing where it conflicted with Dayton officially going 18-0, the end of the year awards, the conference tournament preview, all this stuff, the rise of Richmond, is the fact that once Langevin got hurt, Rhode Island just died. Mm-hmm. Because he was so critically important to their defense. And those last, I think, six games where he was either out or just clearly not moving right. And you saw it in the Dayton game. Like, this was a Rhode Island team that was built on their interior defense, and Dayton was just going to the hoop every single time, and they couldn't stop them.
All right. I think we have six or maybe seven teams to go. Anyway, let's move on to another big winning streak I want to talk about, and that was by the Duquesne Dukes, who opened up the season 10-0. And my best memory of the Dukes this year were the undefeated maps that got tweeted out just about every day during the non-conference. And eventually it came down to Auburn and San Diego State as the last undefeated team standing. But Duquesne was on that map for a long time. And I want to say they were maybe in the last five or six that still hadn't lost a game. And my favorite memory from that is I remember people replying to those tweets just completely pooping on Duquesne, saying, oh, these guys haven't played anybody. Duquesne wouldn't stand a chance against these teams. And I was just thinking about it, and no offense, Tyler, but Duquesne's been really bad for a really long time. Do you think that's like the first time since, I don't know, the golden age in the 1950s when Duquesne actually had haters? Because I feel like people just haven't had much of a reason to be mad at the Dukes. But that 10-0 streak to start the year, that was impressive.
Normally, they've lost to a terrible Northeast Conference team by that point in the season. Everyone's just pities them. Or I guess NJIT's not in the NEC. So
not anymore.
just some crappy low-major Northeastern team.
Yeah. But I thought that
winning
streak,
crazy. I'll actually pick something that was mentioned earlier in a different context. And that is Sincere Carey making the two game-tying foul shots against St. Bonaventure in the Riley Center as the phallic balloon gets thrown on the court. And it became more of a meme than anything because of the ridiculousness of the situation. And, of course, the fans cost them the VCU win years ago. But it actually kind of ended up being the biggest moment of the year for Duquesne. They were on an 8-game losing streak against the Bonnies going into that moment. They had lost a really tough one at Robert Morris earlier in the month of February. And quite frankly, that team was falling apart very quickly. They had had the top four on lock until mid-February. They were coming into this game having lost two out of their last three, including an embarrassing one at home to GW. Three of their last four. And the win was beating Fordham in a game where they played terribly and just got lucky. And you could look ahead to the schedule and see that they were closing with the three Virginia teams. And things were looking really bleak for the Dukes. They go into the Riley Center. They come back in the final minutes. They end up winning in overtime. And Carey just calmly hitting those two clutch foul shots to send it into overtime was the big signature of the game.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. I think it's either that one or I think the second St. Louis win for me, that was a really Like, you know, I think there was a time there when I was thinking that Duquesne was headed for a top four finish. And part of part of the reasoning behind that was just how easily they handled a really good St. Louis team. I think that's a, you know, it's a matchup that they play pretty well because they can match St. Louis's strength on the interior with those guys, Michael Hughes and Bailey Steele, who Bailey Steele, I think, was a grad transfer and won't be coming back. But then, you know, I think that they the second St. Louis win on the road, they just handled them very easily. They won by 14, Sincere Carey, 14 points, 8 assists. That would be mine for Duquesne. I thought that was a really huge win for them.
Yeah, and the other thing that needs to be mentioned, because Duquesne had such an up and down season where I think they might have more memorable games than anyone else except for probably Dayton, because they had so many terrible games where the loss at home to GW, where they looked like crap for 30 minutes, and then Carey inexplicably willed them back, but they couldn't finish it. Both Fordham games, they should have lost 100% in both of those, and they just pulled it out in the end. But then they had a bunch of great moments, beating St. Louis, like you mentioned, the Bonaventure one, like I mentioned, and two that will go unnoticed just because of how the teams finished. This was their first ever win in program history over both Davidson and VCU this year.
Really? Both first ever win over both of them in the same year?
No, they had never beaten either of them.
Yeah, Duquesne doesn't have a very good history.
Really?
They were 0-8 against both going into the year.
Wow, I don't think I knew that. That's crazy. Yeah, and Duquesne also just plays a fun style. I think it's like partly to their detriment, because sometimes when you watch them play, you wish they were a little more structured, because their offense just sort of devolves and like guys take a lot of bad shots. But it also makes it fun. Like, I love watching Tavian Dunn-Martin, because you never know when he's going to pull up from 28 feet for absolutely no reason, because there's plenty of time on the shot clock, but yeah. he's feeling it. So yeah, Duquesne's a fun team to watch, man. I like them.
Yeah, we're calling you after the first great TDM game of the season, because we're the only two prominent members of A10 Twitter who don't hate them.
Oh, really? Oh, I love TDM. I get why people probably wish he like would take better shots, but you know, it's part of the fun. It's part of the TDM experience.
Oh no, the Bonnies fans and the SLU fans both hate him.
Yeah, it's mostly those guys, I think, but yeah. It is what it is. All right, we are down to five teams, I believe. Three of them were very good. Two of them were very bad. Petey, which one do you want to move on to first?
Oh, man. I'll be that guy. Let's talk about Fordham.
All right.
Is there anything to talk about with Fordham? Fordham has Fordham won three games in conference, two in the regular season, one in the A-10 tournament. All of them against George Washington, which is just hilarious. I'll take the A-10 tournament win over George Washington. They are one of two teams, along with my George Mason Patriots, to win a game in the A-10 tournament this year. And yeah, I think they just have a horrible matchup for the way that GW likes to play. But I think still, like, nobody believed it, because everybody kind of believes in this GW team, and nobody ever believes in Fordham. So going into the A-10 tournament, everybody like wrote off those first two losses as a fluke. But then, nope, in the A-10 tournament, GW's never even in the game. Fordham wins by 15. And then because Fordham winning in the A-10 tournament is a sign of the apocalypse, everything else gets canceled after that.
Yeah, I know. First of all, congratulations to Fordham, A-10 tournament champions. That's great for them. But I know when we talked to the Bonnies guys a couple weeks ago, they mentioned that next year when Fordham and George Mason meet, that will have to go down as the Corona Classic, and maybe the winner of that game will be the true A-10 champions for this year. Yeah, but all right, Tyler, I want you to go next, because my Fordham one actually might take a minute, and it's not going to be something you expect, maybe. So I want you to go next, Tyler.
So there's really only three potential answers. Obviously, sweeping GW and having the final win of the A-10 season is probably the true answer. I could also go with Onye Iesi just destroying Davidson in the first half of that January Sunday game, where we were all waiting for football to start, and that was basically the only sporting event on TV at the time. But Jeff Neubauer showed up to practice shirtless, wearing a pair of shoes that if he tried to walk into LA Fitness with, they would not have allowed him onto the basketball court. They would have had to send an attendant out there to kick him out. I can't think of a coach in the A-10 that would have been funnier to see that happen with. Like, you look at a guy like Anthony Grant. If we just saw a picture of him shirtless at practice, it wouldn't be that weird. He's in great shape. Keith Dambrot, everyone thinks he's crazy anyway. He's probably took it off to make a point. Jeff Neubauer's just standing there looking like he's ready to go down to the Boca Raton tournament and hang out with Bobby Plenutis. But it's the middle of winter in the
It sounds like you might have a shirtless coach power ranking.
Man, that's a great idea for an off-season topic. We're going to be searching everywhere for content, so we'll have to keep that in mind. Maybe have you back on to help us out with that.
Perfect.
So on that note, actually, I'm pretty sure Fordham is playing in a Florida tournament. I think it's like the Fort Myers tip-off or something, so maybe Neubauer's going to head to the beach for a little bit. I'm sure that's not a coincidence that they ended up down south for a tournament. But anyway, my moment for Fordham, I was looking for something that perfectly summarized just how terrible they were offensively. And when I say terrible, this Fordham squad was probably the worst offensive team we've seen in the A-10 in quite some time. So Tuesday during finals week at Dayton, I was at the library just trying to get some work done. But then I noticed, hey, there is an afternoon basketball game between Fordham and Bryant. I might put that on in the background, just check it out. I don't watch Fordham that much, so maybe I'll get to learn something about their team. Pretty close game in the first half. It might have been tied. Second half, this is important. Josh Colon made a layup with 17 minutes and 20 seconds to go. Fordham's next field goal didn't come until Ertan Ghazi made a shot with 2:21. So the Rams went 15 minutes between made field goals. That was pretty amazing. I wasn't paying that close of attention to the game since I just had it on my phone while I was trying to study, although Fordham basketball can be pretty distracting at times. But I just thought that was amazing. I didn't even notice it until about 10 minutes had passed by that they hadn't made a shot. And they did make a few field or free throws in there. But man, when you can't score for 15 minutes against Bryant, I think that says it all about just how bad you are with the ball in your hands.
Yeah, 347th in the country in offensive efficiency on KenPom out of, 353 teams? Bottom five or bottom 10.
Yeah.
They were truly, truly awful.
Yeah, it's really hard to... Like, we make fun of Fordham, and it's mostly deserved, but... I mean, they deserve everything for just how bad they were offensively. They were... literally only better than a small handful of teams in the entire country. But they were somehow pretty good on defense, so that's kind of interesting. They actually, for a while, were one of the only teams to hold Dayton to 70 points, I think, which was pretty funny.
Yeah, so we got four teams left, and I'm hoping we're all kind of in silent agreement as to who we should end it with at this point. So I'll take the second place team in the A-10 this year, the Richmond Spiders. This one, tough given they went the entire 18-game conference season without playing crunch time one single time. The last time they were in a game that was within one possession in the final minute was on December 18th against Old Dominion. So I ended up going with the season finale against Duquesne, a game that was really kind of the perfect Richmond game where – if you look at the box score, all of their starters gave great contributions in the exact places that they're supposed to. But for me, most importantly, it's the defensive performance by Jacob Gilliard in the second half that will hang with me through the rest of the offseason. He ends up with six steals in the game, but I think he had at least three more just important deflections. And, you know, we're going through the last dance, and the great hallmark of Michael Jordan's career was that in every big moment, he took over the game on offense. Well, against Duquesne, Jacob Gilliard did that on defense. And every time the Dukes started climbing back, they got it down to one possession. They had the ball. And then just out of nowhere, here's this 5'9 blur of Jacob Gilliard. takes it away from Sincere Carey. He deflects a pass into someone else's hands. And just every time the Dukes were about to turn the tide in that game, Jacob Gilliard stepped up. And, you know, at that moment, I was debating between, I think, five guys for my Defensive Player of the Year award. When that was over, I just went and wrote down Jacob Gilliard's name because there was nothing anyone else could have done on that Saturday to match what Gilliard did to wrap up the year. It was the best individual defensive half by an A-10 player in years.
Yeah, I think I love Jacob Gilliard. I think did he make first team this year? I think he made first team. I still don't know if he's properly appreciated by A-10 fans. He's amazing. He's absolutely tremendous. I don't know. I'm kind of going to like cop out because of the fun factor that you said. They're a great team, but they didn't play a lot of great like individual games, or at least not a lot of like memorable games if you're not a Richmond fan in conference. I thought their overtime win against Vanderbilt early in the season, I thought that was just a really, really fun game. So I'm going to go with that one. I know it's kind of silly because Vanderbilt was not a good team at all this year, but I think opening the season, they had that overtime win against St. Francis or somebody. And then they played this absolute back and like, we didn't know they were good yet. They probably weren't good at that point yet, but they figured it out later. But they played this absolute back and forth roller coaster kind of game against Vanderbilt. And, you know, Vanderbilt's not good, but, you know, they're long, they're athletic. They pose like a lot of different problems for a team that's small and doesn't rebound very well like Richmond. So I would say that the Vanderbilt win was, I think, probably one of the games that sticks out to me as one of the most fun, just randomly fun games that happened in the A-10 this year. So I'm going to go with that one. Ended 93-92, just back and forth. Richmond had to come back and actually tie it up late to send it to overtime. And then they held off Vanderbilt by 1 point in overtime. So that would be my choice.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Tyler and I hyped up Richmond quite a bit before the season. I think we both had them as a sneaky, maybe possible bubble team, and they ended up being very good this season. Although I remember after those first two games, I was just thinking, man, they've won two games by a combined 3 points, both in overtime. They needed a huge comeback both times. Like, you guys are really playing with fire, but they ended up getting much better after that, especially defensively. But since we talked a lot about Richmond's success on this podcast throughout the season, and it was well deserved. They went 14-4, and they were going to get the 2 seed in Brooklyn. So I wanted to bring up maybe a more embarrassing moment for the Spiders, and that was at the end of the Dayton game. The Flyers were ahead by as much as 20 in the second half, but Richmond started to hit some threes. They started to come back. But unfortunately, Nick Sherrod called a timeout with under a minute to go, and the Spiders didn't have any. So that was the first Chris Webber timeout I believe I've ever seen live as it happened. And that's just something that stuck out to me. That was actually a pretty fun game because Richmond was really good in the first half, and then Dayton just kind of did their thing in the second half where they suddenly go up by 15. But yeah, that Chris Webber timeout by Nick Sherrod, I'm sorry to bring that up to the Spider fans, but we said a lot of really nice things about your team this year, so I just had to remind everyone of that one more time.
No, that was good. I forgot about that. And I wanted to get in one last thing about my Vanderbilt game pick.
Oh, yeah.
We all thought that like it was a fun game, but everybody thought Richmond was in deep shit this year because they scored 93 points. And only three of them came off the bench. So four guys combined for 84 of their points. And then Grant Golden did not have a good game. He scored 6. Gustafson off the bench scored 3. And nobody else scored any. So we were like everybody like thought like, hey, fun win, fun game. Richmond's got serious problems. but, you know, yeah, credit to them. They figured them out throughout the season.
Yeah. I said one more thing for Richmond, too. They probably had the best win of the season in the A-10. Sorry, VCU fans, but beating Wisconsin on a neutral court, especially with how good the Badgers were looking at the end of the season, that was probably what was going to get Richmond in the tournament if they made it, because Wisconsin was about to be like a 4 or 5 seed. That was such a great win early on.
Yeah, I can't believe none of us mentioned that.
I considered that, and I was surprised. I thought that for sure one of you would either mention that or the VCU win, because while it didn't mean a ton in the grand scheme of the season, I think the Richmond fans would tell you that that game probably meant the most to them, especially the people who were in the Robbins Center. Just all the firsthand accounts of really that being one of the best regular season nights that that building has ever seen. The Richmond fans knew that they were better than VCU at that point, but the Rams had embarrassed them pretty bad a few weeks earlier. And I think that that's a game that'll stick with the Richmond fans past this season, while it'll be something that'll really fade out of the minds of the rest of the A-10 over the summer.
All right, we are down to three teams. Let's move on to the St. Joe's Hawks, who unfortunately had their worst season in quite some time, although they did manage to escape the basement with a tiebreaker over Fordham when they won, what's that called, the game of the year of the century? They beat Fordham at the end of the year, ended up going 2-16. There's not a whole lot of options when you only win six games, but I'm going to go with the Cam Brown buzzer beater to beat Davidson. The buzzer beater was amazing, but I don't know if a lot of people realized that St. Joe's was down by 19 at halftime, and they just chipped away throughout the second half, and that was their first win of the conference season. I think they were like 0-12 at that point, so huge win for them. It's also just kind of funny to make fun of Davidson for losing. They lost to GW and St. Joe's this year, which is really funny, but yeah. St. Joe's deserved that win. I remember they actually had a decent crowd at Hawk Hill that night, and I was just thinking, man, they haven't even won a game, but their fans were really happy about it, and they actually, it's a small gym, but they filled it up a decent amount, so I was happy for them.
Yeah, I think that was, I think that's the obvious choice, because that was such a cool win. Nobody expected that. They were down so big.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with the Ryan Daly buzzer beater in the first Davidson game.
Yeah.
They sent it to overtime. They ultimately lost, but it was one of the most bizarre buzzer beaters I've ever seen. I think if you look, he kind of like punches the ball or like flips it while he's running. He's like running toward the basket, and he doesn't step over the 3-point line, even though everybody in the world, even like, you know, Billy Lang was like shaking hands after the buzzer, because even if it was good or not, like they were down by three. And it looked like a two in real time. It didn't look anywhere close to a three. But when you played it in slow motion, like, you know, clearly his foot was actually behind the line, even though it didn't look anything like that. Just a strange situation all around. I think he was the only one in the world who knew that it should have counted. Everybody else who was watching, even on TV, thought it was going to be, thought it shouldn't count, or thought it was going to be a two, even if it counted. So I would say that's the moment for me. That was one of the strangest things I've seen in a while.
Yeah, for me, pretty easy. Cam Brown, the buzzer beater to knock off Davidson. They were 0-12 at the time. As Matt mentioned, they make the huge comeback. Ryan Daly didn't even play in that game. And the two other things, Davidson was red hot going into that game. This was right when we started to hear the chatter of, oh, look out for Davidson. They might be making a run for the top four like everyone thought that they would at the beginning of the year. That really doused that fire. And then I think people forget that second half took a really long time. And up next on CBSSN is the red hot Obi Toppin taking on VCU. So I think he ended up making that shot against what probably ended up being a fairly large national TV audience. People who were ready to come tune in to see Obi Toppin, and all of a sudden there's this 0-12 team that won on a buzzer beater. That was the obvious choice for me, but since Matt talked about that anyway, I'm going to cheat a little bit. They won the game of the year of the century, an early Saturday afternoon game against Fordham, only watched by people who are either hardcore A-10 lovers, gamblers, or just people who simply had nothing to do on that Saturday, stumbling around on ESPN Plus. It was actually kind of a fun second half where Cameron Brown, I remember it was Cameron Brown and Jalen Cobb just taking crazy shots against one another. Some of them were falling, a lot of them were missing, but both teams were playing with some pretty great pace, and it ended up just being a fun up and down basketball game.
All right, real quick, we also need to mention St. Joe's beat Danny Hurley in UConn this year. Am I the only one that actually thought St. Joe's might be respectable? Because they were 2-1 at one point. I didn't think they were ever going to be good at any point, but when they beat UConn, I really thought they could be at least, like, I don't know, 9th or 10th place. Man, I didn't see what was coming next, but shout out to them for beating Hurley. I'm always happy to see that.
It looked like they had a shot to be good, and then they completely destroyed all that confidence in one half when they went to Loyola, and Cameron Kretwig just showed us all right then and there that they had no interior defense at all.
All right, we are down to two teams, I guess, since we agreed on who would be last. Let's move on to the St. Louis Billikens, who finished the season as strong as any team in the conference, and they kind of snuck up on everybody to take over the 4 seed. And this was a really, overall, I think, a successful season because they lost a really good senior class after winning the 2019 A-10 championship. And so for this one, I'm going to go with their last game of the season, which clinched them the 4 seed. They beat St. Bonaventure. And the interesting thing about this, which I will share with our listeners, is that Tyler and I have a competition every year picking A-10 games against the spread. This was the last game of the year, and we were tied going into it. I needed St. Louis to cover 5.5 points, and they sure did. They took the 4 seed. I was very happy about that. And it was also a big win for the Billikens, so I'm going to use that as their greatest moment of the season.
I had the lead for the first 19 rounds of A-10 games.
Yep, but got it when it mattered. The Billikens were red hot. They won by 23, wasn't even close. Didn't even watch that game because that was after Dayton beat GW on the last day of the year, so I was at that game, but was happy to pull that win out. That was nice.
Yeah, I think you could pick either of their last two weekend games, blowing out St. Bonaventure to win the Flint, Michigan Mega Bowl, fourth place. But I'm going to go with the one from the weekend before. Taking on Rhode Island in the Ryan Center, the Rams really kind of on the last legs of their NCAA tournament hopes. And as I mentioned earlier, Rhodey's calling card throughout the conference season was their interior defense. And this just turned into a classic Travis Ford game where they just punched Rhodey in the mouth repeatedly. They end up going 31 of 59 from the field. They only missed 5 foul shots, so I guess that's pretty good for SLU standards. But this was just the ultimate. When you have Jordan Goodwin and Hassan French on your team, they're going to do good things for you without flashy numbers. French goes 12 points, 14 boards. Goodwin, 17 points, 10 boards, 4 assists. Just really unflashy box score numbers from them. But this was one of those games where if you watched it from start to finish, there was really no question who the two best guys on the court were.
Yeah, I think that's a good contender. I'm going to have to go with the St. Louis fan doing the surrender cobra and getting on SportsCenter for it after Crutcher hit that 3. No, just kidding.
That's a perfectly acceptable answer.
That was pretty awesome.
Don't worry.
He's on Twitter. He's part of A10 Twitter. He's got a great sense of humor about it. I think it's his profile picture. But no, seriously, my serious answer is Hassan French's game against Belmont. Probably the single most, maybe not the single best game, but the single most dominant game I saw in the A10 this year. Hassan French, 21 points, 24 rebounds, 7 blocks. If you were watching this game, the Belmont was just powerless to stop Hassan French from doing whatever he wanted. He was an absolute monster. He went just absolutely crazy in this game. Tough to sort of describe like what it looked like, but it looks like when, I don't know if like intramural basketball in college or whatever, when one team has the guy that's just so much bigger and so much better than everybody else that it's just not fair. That's what the Belmont St. Louis game looked like, because Hassan French was just such a monster then. So that would be my pick, my serious pick for the St. Louis season.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I actually had that written down as an honorable mention, and I didn't start watching that game until there were about 5 minutes to go, but You're right. I remember down the stretch, they just kept going to French, and it seemed like every possession where St. Louis was on offense, he was just pounding it inside, getting a basket, and then he was blocking a shot or getting a rebound on the other end. So that was one of probably the most dominant performances we saw by an individual player, and I think that's just the perfect type of game for him, where he can just use his strength to bully a team inside, and that was a lot of fun to watch, so I'm glad you brought that up. All right.
Yeah.
We are down to our final team of the 2019-2020 recap, the Dayton Flyers, who went 29-2, 18-0 in the A-10. I watched all those games, and it still seems kind of silly to say that. It doesn't feel like it actually happened, but honestly, I'm not going to lie. It was really tough for me to just pick one game, I think, is the defining moment for Dayton. And what I went with, I don't think most Dayton fans would pick, because it wasn't one of the most important games for UD. But to me, it just kind of represented Dayton's success as a whole. I thought the Davidson game at the end of the season was just so enjoyable as a Dayton fan. It was on ESPN on a Friday night in prime time. I want to say Dayton was ranked 4th or 5th in the country, so they were obviously getting a lot of attention at that point in the season. We had Dick Vitale in the house, which was important to me because the last time Dick Vitale called a Dayton game was the 2015 Advocare Championship when we lost to Xavier by 29, so I was hoping we'd do a little bit better this time around, and that's what happened. But the biggest takeaway from this game, Dayton went 27 for 28 on two-point shots, which is just ridiculous. I don't think I'm ever going to see that happen again. And I think that game just perfectly represented how well Dayton shared the basketball. They just methodically picked apart Davidson's defense the entire game, and I don't think they took a single bad shot. So even though that wasn't the most impressive win of the season, and it really wasn't that important of a game in the grand scheme of things, as a Dayton fan, that game was just so enjoyable to watch, and it just reminds me of how great that offense was throughout the entire season.
27 of 28 shouldn't be possible.
No.
It was like, Jalen Crutcher was the asshole. He was only 2 for 3 from two.
And I'm pretty sure he might have missed his first shot attempt of the game.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Yeah, it was the first two of the game that they missed. Yep. And then they made 27 consecutively.
It's just ridiculous.
Against we make fun of Davidson because they're not a great defensive team this year. But still, like 27 in a row against a team that's like a Division I basketball team. That's absurd. I guess I'll go with mine. I think that's a good one. I've got it. Like Dayton has such a great season. I think the obvious choice is the Crutcher buzzer beater over St. Louis, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's been like rehashed to death. So I don't know if we need to go there.
Yeah.
Honorable mention. I'll say like the Maui game against Kansas was awesome. Like it sucked that they lost. They were in it the whole time, but that was like Dayton announced that like we're here and we're not messing around, right? Because you were watching that game. It was like, it was not a fluke that Dayton was in that game. It wasn't like a plucky little underdog who, you know, was punching above its weight for one time. It was like Dayton was just like had just as much of a right to win that game as Kansas did. And so I think that was like I would definitely put that one up there, even though I know it's one of only two losses on the season, so it sounds kind of weird.
Yeah.
But that was the moment everybody knew that Dayton was like absolutely legit, and this is like going to be one of the best teams in the country.
Mm-hmm. So for me, there's really five moments. I'm glad you guys took my number two and my number three. The two basically honorable mentions for me, the Kansas game, which probably would have been number one if they had pulled it out. And then Monday at Maui, which people kind of forget about, where Rodney Chapman and Dwayne Cohill just absolutely smothered Anthony Edwards the entire game. He basically just looked like your average everyday starting shooting guard, and now this guy might be the number one pick in the NBA draft. Those two just absolutely bitch slapped him the whole game. But there were really the true big three A-10 moments. The Davidson game just being the perfect tactical clinical example of how to play perfect team basketball that we've maybe ever seen in college basketball. Such a beautiful game, but the biggest part of it was just the 27 for 28, we kind of didn't realize it was going on as it was happening. It was something that really kind of kicked in after the game when it bounced to SportsCenter and SVP starts dropping the stat, or you really start to see, or when you go check the box score late in the game, it really snuck up on you. And I think most people would pick the Crutcher shot. It was obviously essential to them going 18-0, but Dayton played a pretty crappy game that night. And in terms of just a pure basketball standpoint, crunch time and then into overtime, both teams missed a lot of foul shots and things got ugly. So for me, I'm taking the game earlier that same week at home against VCU, and really just the quintessential of what this Dayton team was. VCU ties the game with 17 and a half minutes to go. And then just like a clap of thunder coming from the sky on a sunny day, Dayton just goes haywire on a 22-0 run. It took them 11 possessions to score 22 points because they had one turnover. They had one turnover, eight twos and two threes in a span of about 5 minutes. And it was at that moment where you realized that this team was truly something special, that this wasn't just a good offense, that it was really an all-time elite offense. It wasn't Obi just getting loose. It wasn't Jalen Crutcher stepping it up and taking over the game. When you look at the run of the guys making baskets, it's Toppin, then Landers, Toppin, Landers again, Chapman, Landers a third time, Crutcher, Toppin, Toppin again, and then Watson. And it was just the whole idea of this Dayton team mentality, that beautiful offensive unit of Crutcher, Chapman, Watson, Landers, and Obi Toppin, just eviscerating what was at that point one of the better defenses in all of college basketball.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, and I think to that point about like realizing that Dayton's a great offensive team, like back to the Crutcher game, like where he hits the three against St. Louis, Dayton went down in the second half, and I rewatched the game, and I was really surprised to see that like their comeback was the result of like a lot of individual playmaking. Like what made them great throughout the season was they shared the ball so well and generated so many open looks. But that comeback against St. Louis started with I think three or four step back threes, mm-hmm. that like under most circumstances are not good shots, but when you've got guys like Watson, Chapman, Crutcher shooting them, they'll go in at a pretty high rate. And so like that's actually how they got back in the game against St. Louis. They even set up that ridiculous Crutcher buzzer beater in the first place.
I think after that St. Louis game, which it's kind of crazy to say because that only got Dayton to 5-0, but that's really when I started to believe they could go undefeated, because the way I saw it, if you can play that bad for 35 minutes and then just catch fire to win in that tough of an environment, you're going to be really tough to beat. And that ended up happening, which is kind of crazy to think. But as promised, I couldn't come up with just one moment for Dayton, so I have two quick honorable mentions, one for each of the seniors on this team. First, Tyler, going back to the 22-0 run you mentioned against VCU, Trey Landers hit the heat check of his life right in the middle of that run that caused a timeout. And that was one of those typical no-no-no-yes shots where it wasn't smart at all because Trey can't really shoot threes, but it went in. And then the other honorable mention a couple weeks later, we were very lucky to see over 100 incredible Obi Toppin dunks throughout his career at Dayton, but one of the most memorable during the season, to me, came against St. Bonaventure a few weeks after that game. Ryan Mikesell caught a lob from just inside half court and threw it down. Mikesell, you could probably count his dunks on two hands from last season, but he really brought the house down on that one. And then he actually raised the roof on his way back down the court on defense. So I even though with Obi on the team, it maybe wasn't one of the best dunks of the year, but certainly one of the most memorable to me.
Yeah, one of the games that I had on our honorable mention for them was game day coming to Dayton.
Yeah.
The GW game, the game itself kind of stunk, but I thought it was cool for Dayton fans to get that moment in the second half when they broke away and the game basically turned into a dunk fest, an Obi Toppin dunk show. I thought that was, you know, not, I think, what the lasting memory of this Dayton team is going to be, but I thought in terms of moments, I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, that was a fun night. And unfortunately, we didn't know that would be the last night of the season, but it, I mean, if it had to end that way, it did end in a really fun way with all those dunks late in the second half. So, and just the whole game day experience too. That's not something you could ever really expect to come to a team like Dayton. And who knows if that'll ever happen again, but certainly a fun day. All right, so I guess this is all 14 teams. We never really got to do a proper season recap because the season just ended so abruptly, and we've never really seen anything like this. I guess any more comments on the A-10 season as a whole before we wrap this up?
For me, I just want basketball back, man. I think that there's a chance it doesn't start on time, chance the season is really impacted. I'm trying not to think about that because I get too sad when I think about it.
Yeah.
I need A-10 basketball to start on time in November.
For me, this will always be the season of the giant question mark for Dayton because we never got to see what happened in the NCAA tournament. But I think as time moves along and we kind of begin to forget what didn't happen, I think there will be a small level of appreciation for the fact that we never got to see the season end badly. And now, granted, that probably wasn't going to happen because of how great this team was, but we're thinking of it a hell of a lot different if they lose to some mediocre 9 seed in the second round, especially if it ended up being Colorado again, which showed up in way too many bracketologies. But in the end, this will always be the team that went 8-0, had the National Coach of the Year, that had the National Player of the Year, and that basically ended the season. I mean, you can finagle your way into saying they were co-champs because really the only thing we have to declare a champion is the AP poll, and they ended the year with a number one vote.
That's true. Yeah, certainly not the way we wanted the season to end, but, you know, overall, just doing this podcast for me was a lot of fun because it gave me an opportunity to look back at a lot of the really fun memories we had during this season, not just for Dayton, but for all of the teams. And I think just the not knowing what would have happened is probably the hardest thing for Dayton fans. But at the end of the day, I can still find a lot of enjoyment in watching them go 18-0. That's something I'll appreciate forever. And overall, too, just I'm happy the A-10 was stronger this year. Year one of the podcast ended up we covered the worst A-10 in probably 15 years, so that was a huge bummer, but this year it was a lot better. We were, I think, definitely getting two teams to the tournament, maybe three if someone stole a bid, so we still haven't quite lived up to our nickname yet. Maybe that'll happen next year. But overall, just a really fun year in the conference. Glad we got to follow along the whole season, and, you know, hopefully, as PD said, hopefully we see some basketball in November.
Yeah, and really the one lasting memory that I want to end this with is just knowing that we may never see that Dayton offense again. And I'm not talking about from Dayton or even in the A-10. We may never see another offense in college basketball like that again, where at least for the first time in my life, they had this Steph Curry early days Warriors-like trait to them where if they were down and all of a sudden they go on a 6-0 run, it's not much, but you just got that feeling in your gut that that game was about to be over. And they had so many different second half moments where it's, oh, Dayton doesn't have it tonight. They're down by 4. And then you snap your fingers and they're up by 13. And it was just these insane bursts. We saw it against VCU. We saw it against St. Louis. We saw it against Davidson. Countless other games where they basically just snapped their fingers and all of a sudden just went into this own, into this self-created inferno. So with that, we want to thank Petey Buckets for coming on. If you don't already, follow him at Petey Buckets. Just another great source for A-10 basketball, and especially if you want to learn more about George Mason in this coming season. Thank you for joining us, Petey.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on, fellas. It was fun.
Yeah, and so that does it for what I guess is our season recap episode here of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, we thank you guys for listening. Thank you for giving us ratings and comments on iTunes. Be sure to tell a friend and keep an eye out. We'll have some more stuff coming for you in the summer. Hopefully we can get some more fun guests. And before we know it, it'll be time for TBT.